The two largest acts of civil disobedience in Canadian history both happened on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, and were both done for the same reason: protesting the logging of old-growth forests. The largest were the Ferry Creek protests in 2021, where over 1,000 protesters were arrested for blocking logging activities in the area. Previously, the record was held by the Clackwit Sound protests in 1993, known as the War in the Woods, where 856 people were arrested under similar circumstances. Civil disobedience is basically a refusal to comply with certain laws as a non-violent way of political protest. At Ferry Creek and Clackwit Sound, this mainly meant physically blocking and barricading roads to prevent loggers from accessing their work sites. These two events were the largest logging protests in Canada in terms of the number of people arrested, but one of the most notorious logging protests in Canadian history was carried out by just a single person. But this act of civil disobedience was not so civil. Deep in the forests of Haida Gwaii once stood a magnificent spruce tree. Unlike its lush green neighbors who made up the surrounding forest, this spruce had an extremely rare mutation that gave its needles a golden glow. The tree was revered by the local Haida First Nation, and the golden spruce held an important significance in their history. According to local legend, the tree was a young boy that had been transformed after disrespecting nature, which caused a terrible storm to destroy his village. And as they say, those who don't know history are destined to repeat it. Much like the little boy from the legend, in 1997, one man disrespected nature and cut down this sacred tree that had stood for 300 years. But less than a month later, he vanished. No one has seen or heard from him since. This is the story of the golden spruce and the man who killed him. On British Columbia's coast sits a chain of islands called Haida Gwaii, which in the Haida language literally translates to Islands of the Haida People. Along with the entirety of British Columbia's coast, as well as parts of the western United States, it is part of the ecosystem known as the Pacific Temperate Rainforest. Ecologically speaking, this part of the world has a lot going for it. Plenty of rain, moderate summers and winters, and frequent fog that keeps things misty, mossy, and moist. Everything about the conditions here have made for a wildly diverse ecosystem, along with the astounding capability to grow absolutely massive trees. Our story focuses on a particularly special Sitka spruce. The golden spruce was known in the Haida language as Kit Kayas, meaning ancient tree. By the time it was about 300 years old, it was one of the taller trees on the Yukon River, standing 16 stories tall with a circumference of 6 meters at its base. But it wasn't just the height of the tree that made it such a stunning sight. This was a Sitka spruce with a golden hue in its needles that should have otherwise been green, a difference that made it unique to all other known Sitkas. This difference, combined with the tranquility of its location tucked away in the heart of the forest, made the 300-year-old tree a truly magical sight. The golden spruce was born approximately in the year 1700, give or take a few decades. A Sitka spruce cone with a rare genetic mutation had opened up on the bank of the Yukon River and managed to take root. In the forest, competition for sunlight is fierce, and the fact that this particular spruce tree was able to compete at all is its own miracle. I'm sure we've all heard of photosynthesis. Chlorophyll and carotenoids are two types of light-absorbing pigments in plants that harvest the energy needed for photosynthesis. Chlorophyll is green, and carotenoids are typically yellowish. In addition to absorbing light, the carotenoids also act as a barrier for ultraviolet rays from the sun, which can damage and destroy chlorophyll. In a normal healthy tree, usually the chlorophyll dominates the color composition, which gives most living things a green color. For the golden spruce, however, the carotenoids were deficient, meaning that the ultraviolet rays were able to damage any part of the tree exposed to sunlight, killing most of the green chlorophyll and causing the yellow carotenoids to be the dominant pigment in the plant. This also meant that less energy was made available for photosynthesis, which fundamentally limited the tree's ability to grow. In a human, this would be like a chain smoker whose lungs are so damaged that they only have about a third of their normal lung capacity. They would still be able to breathe, but you wouldn't bet on them to be able to finish a marathon. But despite the odds, the golden spruce somehow eked out the competition and not only survived, but thrived. And it lived through historical times for Haida Gwaii. As a child of about 80 years young, it witnessed the arrival of the first European to set foot on the islands. British Captain George Dixon arrived in 1787, and in classic colonial fashion, a name was bestowed upon an already named and inhabited place. Haida Gwaii became known as the Queen Charlotte Islands. As a teenager of about 150 years old, the golden spruce lived through the smallpox epidemic in 1850 that killed 90% of the native human population on Haida Gwaii, leaving only 227 residents behind. And as a young adult, it saw the explosion of the logging industry that would begin to change the surrounding landscape forever. Industrial logging in British Columbia dates all the way back to first contact with European explorers. In 1778, James Cook was the first European to set foot on the coasts of the Northwest and survive the encounter. His ships had sustained damage en route from New Zealand, and they were in need of replacements for their masts. The giant Douglas firs they found on Vancouver Island were more than sufficient replacements. At this time, Europe had been steadily deforesting its lands for millennia, and with the looming Industrial Revolution, it was on its way to losing even more. It became immediately clear to the first colonial explorers just how valuable coastal timber would be back home. Colonization of the West Coast over the next century deforested large amounts of land, for the purposes of both gathering timber, but also to clear land for agricultural use. But at the time, it was a challenge just to get that prime West Coast timber out of the West Coast. Shipments to Eastern North America or Europe required either traversal through the Rocky Mountains to the east, or all the way around the world by ocean to the west or south. The completion of the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1885 lifted this critical trade barrier for the logging industry, making it possible for coastal timber to be easily sent to eastern Canada and the United States. As British Columbia's population began to explode at the turn of the 20th century, the logging industry picked up along with it. By the 1920s, British Columbia timber accounted for half the country's annual cut. Chainsaws were making their way into industrial operations, making it faster and cheaper to extract timber from tree. And at the center of BC's logging success was a man named Harvey Reginald McMillan. With eyebrows that could rival Eugene Levy's, McMillan was a tenacious character and inarguably a determined and accomplished individual. He was born into poverty yet made his way to Yale for graduate studies in forestry, survived tuberculosis in his 20s, and became the first chief forester in BC in 1912, at the age of just 27. In 1919, he took a step into the private sector to found the H.R. McMillan Export Company. Throughout the next 40 years, McMillan split his efforts between shaping forest policy in the province as a regulatory leader and building himself a veritable timber empire. After a number of small acquisitions here and there, and a couple of corporate mergers in the 50s, McMillan Blodell Limited was born. M&B, or MacBlow as it was commonly known as, became internationally recognized and synonymous with Canadian West Coast timber, and they were the face of big log in the country. From phone books, to newspaper, to packaging, to construction materials, MacBlow was not just supplying finished goods, but they were the proverbial bourgeoisie of BC's most valuable natural resource. The forests were the key to their industrial pipeline. But big changes hit the logging industry after the end of World War II. At the time, the legal basis for logging-related activities in the province rested on the 1912 Forest Act, which was the same piece of legislation that brought McMillan to BC in 1912 as chief forester. There were two growing problems in BC's timber industry that became clear after the war. The first issue was that the pace of logging in the province was increasing steadily, and there was no legal way for the province to impose a maximum allowable amount of timber extraction on private companies. The second issue was that 93% of the province's forests were provincially regulated, and there was no good way to transfer the logging rights to private companies without selling the land. Both of these issues were addressed in an amendment to the 1912 Forest Act. The creative name for this crucial piece of legislation was the 1947 Forest Act Amendment Act, or the FAA for short. This legislation introduced two important tools that gave the provincial government control over logging in BC, which are still in effect today. The first was the introduction of what would later become known as the allowable annual cut. This is a hard limit on the maximum amount of timber that could be harvested from all Crown lands in the province in a given year, and could be increased or decreased depending on the needs of the province. In the 75 years this policy has been around, it's seen a few big jumps up and down due to changes in forest policy, but in the first 30 years of its use, it was almost exclusively increased to meet the demands of the province's growing economy. The second important aspect of the bill was the TFL or TML system, Tree Farming License or Tree Management License. In British Columbia, a TFL is basically a lease given by the provincial government to a corporation. A TFL grants a company exclusive rights to harvest timber and manage forest resources in a specific area of Crown land, and for the most part, these licenses can be renewed in perpetuity. Among the assets that eventually made their way into MacBlow's possession, they became the owner of TFL 39, the largest tree farming license in the province. In 1991, TFL 39 consisted of 8,000 square kilometers of land, including patches on the mainland, Vancouver Island, and Haida Gwaii. That's an area 69 times larger than the city of Vancouver. Within these massive TFLs are smaller chunks called blocks. Block 6 is a subset of TFL 39, which includes only the portions of the license on Haida Gwaii. It is here, in Block 6, where the golden spruce had been growing for centuries. MacBlow understood that their activities didn't provide them with the best public image. While the timber they provided helped to build the province and sustain its economy, the sight of a logged forest can be gruesome and devastating. So, like any corporation with a sense of brand awareness, they would engage in PR campaigns to help boost their public image as champions of BC's forests. Take a look at this clip from a promotional movie from the 70s produced by Macmillan Blodell, in which they try to explain how old-growth forests just aren't healthy.
Man has learned even to help the forest against disease, but he has no cure for age. In final solitude, its years of glory spent, choked by a mounting tangle of brush and fallen trees, disease hastens its decay.
We have no cure for old age, so we might as well just rip these trees up and take them home, right? Later on in this movie, we're shown a wildfire breaking out in front of a very concerned raccoon, before the bold and brave MacBlow logging crew manages to put it out. The forest and the wildlife have been saved. That is, until a few weeks later when presumably they cut all that forest down anyway and that poor raccoon is told to get lost. It feels kind of like saving your neighbor from down the block's house from a fire, not because you particularly like your neighbor, but because you were planning on robbing them next week. Another way MacBlow went about managing their public image was through the process of creating set-asides. A typical set-aside would be a minuscule section of forest saved from logging under the guise of conservation, typically while simultaneously mowing down the vast majority of forests on the same lots. This was done by Macmillan's company in 1944 with Cathedral Grove on Vancouver Island, where some of the largest Douglas firs in Canada are today. Cathedral Grove now lies in a well-known provincial park bearing Macmillan's name, thanks to his donation of these lands that his company held the logging rights to. Not so famously publicized is the fact that Macmillan ignored the public desire to conserve this area of forest for almost a decade, before ceding the mere 1.36 square kilometers of land to conservation, or about one-third the size of Stanley Park in Vancouver. The donation represented a functionally insignificant fraction of his company's timber holdings, and the majority of the land immediately surrounding Cathedral Grove has been logged bare since the provincial park was established. But while Cathedral Grove has a provincial highway running directly through it, the golden spruce was off the beaten path, and was honestly a bit unknown even to the local community. Apparently, even in the 1950s, white settlers on the island didn't have a clue that the tree held any special meaning to the Haida. In the 1970s, MacBlow decided to create a similar set-aside for the golden spruce. A trail was run from the nearest road to the east bank of the Yukon, where the golden spruce was visible across the river. The tree itself was not directly accessible from this side of the river, but it was visible and on full display even at this distance. By the 80s, tour buses were eventually making regular stops at the Spruce, and local businesses were benefiting from the increased traffic to the islands. When people first laid their eyes on the Golden Spruce, most would feel some sort of combination of awe, wonder, respect, and for some, spirituality. But when Grant Hadwin first laid his eyes on the Golden Spruce, all he saw was a sick tree. A freak on display, courtesy of MacBlow. And he had a plan to make everyone else see things the way that he saw them. Grant Hadwin was born and raised in West Vancouver to a family heavily rooted in the West Coast tradition of resource extraction. His grandfather had moved to the West Coast to capitalize on the booming timber trade, eventually retiring as the owner of a successful logging supply company. His uncle Angus Monk began working in the woods at the concerningly young age of 13. And his father Tom worked as an engineer for BC Hydro, overseeing the operation of a hydro dam near Vancouver. Tom Hadwin was known as someone who won arguments and valued educational status, two things that certainly didn't help strengthen his relationship with his son. In his youth, Grant was not particularly keen on pursuing academic achievements. In high school, he was much more interested in building backwood cabins and roaming the wilderness of BC. Grant took his first steps into the logging industry in 1966, when he quit school and left home at the age of 16 to work for his uncle Angus. Grant had his uncle's athletic ability and determination, and was well suited for the physically demanding labor. But Hadwin noticed early on in his career that this industry came at a cost. In a visit with an aunt a year into his career at just 17 years old, he talked about how the logging techniques that they were using meant that it was unlikely anything would ever grow there again. A pretty strange concern for a teenager on the West Coast in the 60s. By the age of 20, he had fully adopted the persona of a frontiersman, both in appearance as well as in his habits. Hadwin apparently had quite the capacity for alcohol and frequently chewed tobacco. He earned his forest technician's degree in 1973, which served him well throughout the 70s when the timber trade was in full swing. It was also around this time that he met his future wife, Margaret. When he met her, he quit drinking and tobacco practically instantaneously, and he never went back. They married in 1978, and she gave him a renewed focus in life. They had three children and enjoyed a peaceful decade together, where Grant continued to master his craft in the forests near Goldbridge. Grant Hadwin found his calling as a timber scout and layout engineer. He would typically be the first person in a logging operation on the forest floor, surveying and marking out specific trees for harvest or for exemption. The great difficulty with his job came in planning out where to put logging roads in rugged mountain terrain that semi-trucks would be able to get in and out on to haul timber away. Friends and colleagues described him as a considerate logger and a careful road builder. An old-growth forest in British Columbia is defined as a forest containing trees older than 250 years for forests on the coast, or 140 years for forests in the interior. The definition for the interior forest is more relaxed, since they more commonly see damage from fires and insect infestations. When referring to an old-growth forest as productive, it really means that it is both of high ecological and commercial value. These are forests that contain the full spectrum of trees, from young to old to dead and decaying, which provides a forest with the ecological diversity needed to support a variety of plant and animal species. But they're also typically forests with the most wood that can be extracted and sold. As the first person in a logging operation on the forest floor, he was sometimes even the first non-native person to see these old-growth forests ever. The natural beauty Hadwin experienced would have been spectacular, but it came at a cost. He wasn't being paid to be there just to admire the trees. In contrast to how an architect can turn an empty space into a fulfilled vision, Hadwin's role was to do the opposite. To take a naturally beautiful space and plan out how to remove everything of value. As a logger, Hadwin was exceptionally good at his job, but he was cursed with the understanding that what he did meant that the forests he worked in and loved would never be seen again. These old-growth forests he worked in were all destined for the same gruesome fate, clear-cutting. There are three main methods that exist for extracting timber from a forest. The first method is selection cutting, where a subset of trees from a forest are cut and extracted. In well-managed forests, this subset is selected in a way that removes trees that present risks to the growth of neighboring trees and leaves trees with high potential for growth and propagation. Selection cutting is one of the harder to implement forest management techniques, but when done correctly, it can keep forests healthy while also allowing for sustainable timber extraction. Shelter wood cutting is a more aggressive method compared to selection cutting, where large patches of trees in an area are removed, leaving behind groups of seed-bearing trees that will naturally regenerate the logged area. This method can be beneficial for certain species, since the older trees create an environment where the younger trees have the right amount of sunlight and wind protection to root and grow. At a certain point, the young trees are strong enough to grow on their own, and the old trees can be harvested, beginning the cycle again. However, this method requires more skill to implement. If too many trees are removed, or the wrong kinds of trees are left standing, there are higher risks to the remaining trees being blown over and preventing the forest from regenerating properly. The last and most controversial method is clear cutting, where entire sections of forests are cleared of all trees. This is the most economically profitable method of timber extraction, but its ecological impact is devastating. Depending on how large of an area it's performed, clear cutting can have some catastrophic impacts on the environment. It completely removes habitats and food sources for certain species of wildlife, and it can result in a regrowth of plants that don't mix well with the existing environment's ecology. Clear-cutting in areas adjacent to rivers and creeks reduces tree cover and increases water temperatures, which can threaten the aquatic environment as well. Trees and their topsoil also retain water, so when they're removed, the risk of floods and erosion can become significantly higher. However, there are some instances where clear-cutting can be a good tool to manage a forest. Clear-cutting can be used to mimic the effects of a forest fire, which can be good when an area has become overgrown and at risk of turning into an uncontrollable wildfire. And in some extreme cases, clear-cutting has been used as a last resort in forests that are doomed to be destroyed by natural predators. The largest single clear-cut in the history of British Columbia was in the Barron River Valley near Prince George, in response to a spruce bark beetle epidemic. Spruce beetles burrow their way under the bark of trees to hatch their eggs, which in the process kills the tree. Typically, they're killed off during the winter, since they can't survive the cold weather. But in the 70s, a series of warm winters led to a boom in their population around the Barron Valley. The clock started ticking, and when it came to the trees, it was now use it or lose it. Between 1981 and 1987, the provincial policy was to clear-cut nearly 500 square kilometers to remove the infected trees, reduce the beetle population, and to use whatever timber was salvageable before it became too damaged from the beetles. An area that would have taken 25 to 30 years to cut at the regular allowable annual cut for the time was done in just 7 years. The area has since been reforested, but there's still debate to this day about whether the decision to clear-cut the Barron Valley led to a better long-term outcome for the forest. Clear-cutting has been the historical method of choice for logging in British Columbia. Between 1970 and 1998, clear-cutting was used on 87% of the forest area harvested on public lands. In the 70s, environmental groups were already opposing the logging of the biggest coastal old growth, but no one was really paying attention to the unseen alpine forests that were disappearing. Grant Hadwin was one of the first voices in BC's logging industry to express concerns about the pace and brutality with which forests were being logged, and wanted to explore more sustainable forestry practices. At the same time that the Barron Valley was being stripped of all its timber, Hadwin was working for a company who were taking their own Barron-style approach and gutting the forests near his home of Goldbridge. In 1983, Hadwin quit on bad terms. For the next 3 years, he worked for himself, salvaging timber from beetle-infested forests, attempting to make a living in the logging business without the damage that came from clear-cutting. But the 80s were a tough time for the logging industry all around. On top of the pine beetle epidemic, the Japanese market for BC timber had collapsed, which forced Hadwin back into freelance work scouting timber and laying out roads for big logging corporations. In the summer of 1987, at the age of 38 years old, a switch flipped inside of Hadwin that marked the beginning of his descent down a dark path. On a break between freelance jobs, Hadwin had been venturing out in the woods when he unexpectedly experienced what he considered to be a vision. His concerns for the logging practices he was witnessing came to a boiling point, and he had had enough. When he returned from this experience, he quit his job, disgusted with the work that he and his colleagues were carrying out. To those that knew him, Grant Hadwin had ventured into the woods, and a stranger had walked out. After his vision, Hadwin's paranoia steadily progressed. He moved his family from Goldbridge to Kamloops because he thought that his neighbors were turning against him. He began sending rambling letters to companies, news outlets, and whoever he could. In one letter directed to a provincial Supreme Court judge, Hadwin wrote,
"The forest industry in British Columbia appears to be one example of economic remote-controlled terrorism. On this planet, with professionals leading the way in severe symptoms of denial that there is any problem."
This transformation in Hadwin's behavior was startling, but in hindsight, it's possible that this was one of the first signs of a deeper, hereditary problem for him. You see, Grant Hadwin was not an only child. His brother Donald was 12 years older than Grant, and for the most part, the two didn't have much in common. Donald was an altar boy who got on well with their father. He followed in their father's footsteps and enrolled in UBC's electrical engineering program, after which he sort of drifted away from the family. But Donald re-emerged in 1965 with news. He had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. This experience almost certainly influenced Grant's decision to quit school and leave home the next year. He may have thought this would help him avoid inheriting the same problems his brother had, but his brother's mental condition puts Grant's experience in the woods in 1987 into a different, darker light. In 1971, after walking home from downtown Vancouver one night, Donald Hadwin jumped off the Lions Gate Bridge and took his own life at the age of 34. Grant Hadwin was now 38, and there were concerns that he was heading down a similar path. In 1991, Grant and Margaret separated. She got custody of the kids, and he was slowly becoming untethered from the life that had given him purpose and direction. 2 years later, in 1993, the War in the Woods was taking place on Vancouver Island. Instead of joining in and focusing his frustration with Mack Blow and the logging industry there, Hadwin went north for a trip to Alaska. There, he rented a kayak and planned a week-long paddling excursion in the remote coastal wilderness. He started in the town of Sitka, which is the namesake for the Sitka spruce and the first capital of Alaska during its former Russian ownership. After not showing up on the date indicated in his trip plan, a significant search effort was launched, which included the Coast Guard, state troopers, local police, and volunteers. They eventually found his camp on the south end of Krusoff Island, where they found his abandoned tent, cooking gear, kayak paddle, and some other equipment. Rescuers thought he may have been attacked by a bear, but there was no sign of him or his kayak. His kayak was soon found floating near St. Lazaria Island, along with a document that initially looked like a suicide note from Hadwin. As it turns out, it was something so much more weird. Hadwin had written a 15-page document that he simply titled The Judgment. This was essentially a manifesto for his proposal to bring an end to the ecological destruction being caused by society. He outlined society's continued drift away from nature, and how traditional gender roles encourage a pattern of environmental destruction. He proposed an extreme solution: abolish all religion, do away with currencies, and remove all men from positions of power. The fact that Hadwin came from such a male-dominated world and was of the opinion that to save the Earth, men should be disallowed from governing was a radical idea in an already out there set of proposals. What he proposed came next would be a shift towards small agrarian communities with only pre-industrial revolution technologies, whose sole goal would be to attempt to undo the ecological damage done to the planet over the past 2,000 years of male-led society. Excluding the whole gender role aspect, Hadwin's The Judgment has a lot of similarities to arguably the most famous manifesto ever written, that of Ted Kaczynski, aka the Unabomber. Hadwin's The Judgment was found 2 years before Kaczynski's manifesto was published, but Hadwin's was never fully released to the public. The search for Hadwin continued, and he was eventually found on the northwest coast of Krusoff Island, more than 30 kilometers from his original campsite. Apparently, he had gone on a hike of the island when a major storm hit, and he suspected his boat would be gone, so he just didn't bother to go back to look for it. He had been living off of clams and mussels he scavenged from the ocean by the time rescuers found him. and he didn't even seem particularly enthusiastic about being found, even though all he had with him was a bag of matches, some coffee, and the clothes on his back. After his trip to Alaska, he continued his erratic breakdown south to the US. At the onset of this international trip, he was stopped at the border with, of all things, 3,000 hypodermic needles in the trunk of his car. Apparently, he was trying out being a safe sex and needle exchange advocate and headed to Washington, D.C. to carry out some self-directed charity work. This advocacy trip, or whatever you'd call it, took him from D.C. to Miami, then all the way to Moscow, and then Siberia, where he was briefly arrested, which apparently he managed to talk his way out of. Allegedly, he was there looking for more logging work, but didn't find anything to his liking. When Hadwin finally returned to British Columbia, people he knew were alarmed at the changes that they were seeing in him, and his mental state seemed to be deteriorating. Later that year, he got into an incident on the Trans-Canada Highway, where a road-raging semi-truck driver followed Hadwin all the way to the driveway of his wife's house. Both men got out of their vehicles, some foul words were exchanged, and in the heat of the moment, Hadwin took a 2x4 and clubbed the trucker in the head. Hadwin immediately tried to help the man back to his feet, and then drove himself to the police station to turn himself in. Hadwin was ordered to a forensic psychiatric hospital for evaluation, where he spent a month being assessed by doctors and specialists. The doctors couldn't agree on a specific diagnosis, but they did agree he was having paranoid reactions. He was prescribed a low dose of an antipsychotic medication, which drastically improved his mental state. Hadwin was deemed mentally fit to stand trial, and was given a year's probation. After this encounter with the law and some much-needed psychiatric attention, he secured a job at the local lumber mill and regained custody of his two oldest children. Things started to slowly improve for Hadwin, but unfortunately, it was short-lived. His probation was stressful. He was a man who was used to going wherever his body could take him, and being restricted in where he could go was suffocating. He continued with his tirade of letter writing and faxing, sending letters to native groups, media outlets, politicians, trying over and over to get his thoughts out and his opinions heard. In January of 1996, Hadwin applied for a job posting for a forest renewal project coordinator. He attached a cover letter making clear his requirements for taking the job.
"I do not like clear cutting, and my philosophical differences with the forest industry run deep. If you are prepared to try a gentler approach to forestry with less short-term profit, I may be able to help. I'm not familiar with the new buzzwords such as forest renewal. All of the forestry and most of the forests appear to need renewing in some form or another."
Hadwin did not get the job. In September of 1996, Hadwin visited Haida Gwaii for the first time. The Golden Spruce is halfway between Port Clements, a small logging town, and Jaskatla, the main logging base of operations in Haida Gwaii. From up above the area, you can see just how stark of an effect clear-cutting has had on the landscape on the islands, particularly in Block 6. The area surrounding the Yacoon River has been protected, but as you look around, scars from the clear-cuts decades ago are still visible. Most of the area in Block 6 has been clear-cut at some point in the past century, and the trees that grow there now are cut back down before they could ever get as tall as the old-growth forests on Haida Gwaii once stood. Hadwin would have seen this clear as day, even from the ground, as he made the trip to see the Golden Spruce. When he saw the Golden Spruce for the first time, he saw a sick tree being coveted as its neighbors were being slaughtered, while no one was watching. At this point in his life, Hadwin was a man with strongly formed opinions about the logging industry, lacking a clear form of expression for his anger, and a body that would do just about anything he asked of it. The sight of the tree sickened him, but it also planted a seed of a plan that would finally make people hear what he was trying to say. It's worth drilling home a bit just how much of a physical presence Hadwin was, if you couldn't tell from the image. Logging work is physically demanding, and he met those demands with flying colors. He also had an extreme tolerance for swimming in cold water. Shortly after that first trip to Haida Gwaii in 1996, Hadwin found himself in Whitehorse, Yukon. Most non-locals going that far north in the winter are hoping to see the northern lights, but it seemed like Hadwin was up there mostly to exercise and swim. One frigid minus 35 Celsius day in December, Hadron was taking a dip in the Yukon River near a dam outflow, which was the only area on the river that hadn't frozen solid. Once in the water, he stayed in there for 15 minutes straight. Witnesses were shocked, the Mounties were called, and people were concerned he was going to die. When he finally got out, a friend asked him why he was torturing himself like this. His ominous reply was that he was training himself, and that he wouldn't be around next year. Hadwin left Whitehorse on December 30th, making the 15-hour drive to his destination of Hazelton. At this time of the year, the sun is only up 6 hours of the day, so most of this trip was done by moonlight in the remote northern wilderness. Hadwin ended up getting into a bad accident on the Nass River Bridge, where the highway narrows down to a single lane. He hit a pickup truck head-on at full speed, but other than a cut lip and some frost burns, the seemingly indestructible Grant Hadwin walked away unharmed. Later on, people wondered if this crash was more of a suicide attempt than an accident. Less than 2 weeks later, on January 12th of 1997, Hadwin left to return once more to Haida Gwaii. He gave every impression that this was a one-way trip for him. When he arrived on the island, he started giving away most of his possessions, including items given to him by his father, telling people that he was just going to burn whatever they didn't take. According to a local that he had a few conversations with, he made it clear that he thought terrorism was the most effective way to bring about change, and that he had lately started to wear earplugs because every word he heard felt like a direct insult. It was pretty clear that by this point, Hadwin was either fully off of his medication or his mental condition had gotten significantly worse. He soon purchased some falling wedges, a gas can, and a top-of-the-line chainsaw and made his way to Port Clements. On the night of January 20th, Hadwin drove to the trailhead of the Golden Spruce with his newly purchased equipment. With a temperature floating around 0 degrees Celsius, he made the short hike along the trail to the bank of the Yukon River. He stowed his equipment and clothes into garbage bags, and with his luggage in tow, he stepped into the flowing current of the Yukon. He swam across the frigid river, climbed the steep bank on the other side, and in the dead of the night, with no one around for miles, he got to work carving up the base of the Golden Spruce. This was not the first tree Hadwin had felled, and he knew exactly what he was doing. Most trees are felled in a two-step process, cutting a notch out of the tree in the direction of its natural lean, then making a felling cut from the backside of the wedge, deep enough until the tree gets put off balance and sends it falling in more or less a predictable direction. Hadwin was doing something more complicated with the Golden Spruce. He didn't cut the notch in line with the tree's natural lean, but instead with the direction of the wind. And he didn't make the felling cut deep enough to actually make it fall. He left the cut shallow enough so that the tree would be precariously balanced, such that the tree would stay standing until the next storm came through and tipped it over. And just like that, after 300 years, the Golden Spruce was one strong gust away from tumbling to its grave. With the Golden Spruce hanging on for dear life, Hadwin returned to Masset the next day and took a plane back to Prince Rupert. After checking into a hotel, he sent off a barrage of fax letter copies to a variety of individuals, organizations, and news outlets, taking responsibility for the damage done to the Golden Spruce. The intended recipient for his message was clearly Macmillan Blodell.
Re: the falling of your pet plant. Dear sir or madam, I didn't enjoy butchering this magnificent old plant, but you apparently need a message and a wake-up call that even a university-trained professional should be able to understand. I mean no disrespect to most of the Haida people, by my actions, or to the natural environment of Haida Gwaii. I do, however, mean this action to be an expression of my rage and hatred towards university-trained professionals and their extremist supporters, whose ideas, ethics, denials, part-truths, attitudes, etc. appear to be responsible for most of the abominations towards amateur life on this planet.
The next day, while Grant Hadwin was holed up in Prince Rupert, on Haida Gwaii, the Golden Spruce spent its final day in a precariously balanced mangled mess before creaking and groaning as it came tumbling down to the forest floor. Hadwin was arrested by the RCMP on two charges: illegal cutting of timber on Crown land and damage in excess of $5,000. Usually cutting down a tree on Crown land would land you a fine or some minor jail time, but this was no ordinary tree, and the prosecutors would be coming for Hadwin with the full extent of the law. Initially, he was ordered to appear in court in Masset on April 22nd, to face criminal and poetic justice on Earth Day, of all days. But later, his court date was moved up to February 18th, presumably due to the high-profile nature of his case. While he was considered by some to be a flight risk, there was no legal reason to detain him, so he was released on a $500 bail. The full text of Hadwin's letter was published in newspapers, which began a hostile back and forth between Hadwin and locals who were infuriated by his actions. Hadwin tried to give his side of the story to whoever would listen.
"We tend to focus on the individual trees like the golden spruce, while the rest of the forests are being slaughtered. Everybody's supposed to focus on corporate set-asides and forget all the damage behind it. When someone attacks one of these freaks, you'd think it was a holocaust. The real holocaust is somewhere else. Right now, people are focusing all their anger on me when they should focus it on the destruction going on around them."
Hadwin's goal was to get people to face an uncomfortable truth. How can we consider it a victory that these tiny, functionally insignificant sections of forest are protected while so much more old-growth forest behind the veil is being decimated? But the problem with his message is that it failed in who it targeted. There's a lot of similarity between Hadwin's protest and the rising popularity of protests where people vandalize famous pieces of art to draw attention to climate change. Climate change is clearly an important issue, and getting uninterested parties to engage can be challenging. But the source of problems related to climate change aren't coming from 19th century post-impressionist artists, or museums, or the art industry. High-profile attractions are being used as a shortcut to boost their message, without confronting the source of their grievances head-on. These protests miss the mark and rub people the wrong way, because while people may agree with the underlying message, the execution puts innocent bystanders in the crossfire. For the golden spruce, the Haida people were the ones in the crossfire. The sense of devastation within the Haida community was profound. For them, Kid Kayas was not just a tree, but a boy from legend embodied within the ancient spruce, who had been killed in the emotional equivalent of a drive-by shooting. But alongside this loss, there was a deep rage towards Hadwin for what he had done. Apparently, Hadwin didn't even know that the golden spruce held a special significance to the Haida people when he cut it down. There was a real possibility that even with judicial proceedings in the works, that the Haida locals would take the matter of punishing Hadwin into their own hands. This would have surely been on Hadwin's mind. There was no reason to indicate Hadwin would try to evade his court date on the island, but with a target on his back, making it there in one piece would be a challenge. Amidst his paranoia and brute force self-determination, he made yet another baffling decision. Starting from Prince Rupert, he was going to get to court at Masset by kayak. Haida Gwaii is separated from the mainland by the Heckett Strait, which is arguably the most dangerous body of water on Canada's west coast. Because it's so shallow, and because opposing northern and southern storms often collide in the strait, it's an incredibly chaotic place to be on a small boat like a kayak. More than 1,000 vessels have sunk in these waters in the past 200 years, and waves can reach over 30 meters tall. Veteran kayakers don't ever attempt this kind of crossing to Haida Gwaii. There is, however, another route to get to Haida Gwaii by small boat, and that's through the Dixon Entrance. Instead of traveling due west from Prince Rupert, if you were to head north, you could island hop your way from the mainland coast through to the south end of either Prince of Wales Island or Dal Island. From there, going south towards Haida Gwaii would let you cut the wind and the tide, which is a much safer bet than crossing the Heckett directly. Keeping in mind that this last leg would still be 60 kilometers of exposed ocean waters in the cold February rain and wind, at least partially at night. Not a walk in the park by any stretch. During Hadwin's last days in Prince Rupert, he prepared for his trip, which he would be making in a recently purchased white sea kayak, along with some standard survival equipment like emergency flares, a spare paddle, and an axe that he kept lashed to the front of his vessel. He made a call to the Haida leadership, letting them know his trip plan in what almost seems like a death wish. He told them that if they were so inclined, they could meet him out on the water where there would be no police around to protect him. Now, not only was he going to be fighting against Mother Nature to get to the island, he had broadcast his location to the people that most wanted to see him punished. At dusk on February 11th, with his kayak packed and his resolve steady, Grant Hadwin set off from Prince Rupert directly into a storm. Records from that night show that waves had reached up to 3 meters and winds upwards of 50 kilometers per hour. With the wind chill, temperatures out on the water would have been close to minus 20 Celsius, where a normal person would be at risk of hypothermia within half an hour. And while Hadwin was no normal person, he had only a raincoat and dish gloves to protect him from the water, and was clearly underprepared in the clothing department. He recognized this, and managed to make his way back into Prince Rupert. He bought some warmer clothes, as well as a chart for the Hecate Strait, which apparently he went without the first time. On the dawn of February 13th, with only 5 days until his court date in Masset, Hadwin took off once more north from Prince Rupert. On the morning of the 14th, he was spotted in the waters near Port Simpson, about 40 kilometers north of Prince Rupert. It's possible Hadwin was hugging the shoreline and taking the cautious approach up the coast until he could get closer to hop over to Prince of Wales Island. But he had 4 days left until his court date and needed to keep making progress, especially with some of the hardest parts of the trip left to go. By the time February 18th rolled around, the Masset courthouse was packed, with a community still on edge waiting to see Hadwin face the music. When Hadwin's name was finally called at 9:30 a.m., he was not there. No one was quite sure what he looked like, but even after it became clear that he wasn't there, the audience stayed put. His name was called again at 10 a.m. With no Hadwin and no one to act on his behalf in court, Grant Hadwin had officially become a fugitive. A bench warrant was issued for Hadwin's arrest, and the RCMP began their search for him. Hadwin's wife Margaret had known her husband to disappear into the wilderness before, and initially wasn't all that concerned by the news of his disappearance. She told the RCMP that their daughter's birthday was coming up on March 1st, and that Hadwin was a loyal father who never missed making a call to his children on their birthdays when he was away. This would be a test of whether or not he was alive and well. But March 1st came and went with no phone call, and that's when Margaret knew that something was wrong. This triggered the start of a search for Hadwin by both the Canadian and US Coast Guards. Over the next few months, there were multiple reports that Hadwin had been spotted. Someone thought they saw him in Bella Bella. Another person claimed to spot him in Hyder. A month after Hadwin went missing, a man was found stranded on Mary Island who matched Hadwin's description. But it turns out it was a different person who was likely a survivor of a drug smuggling operation turned shipwreck. By the spring, it was becoming clear that Hadwin was unlikely to ever be found. But in June, 4 months after his disappearance, a discovery was made, again on Mary Island, by a beachcomber. The wreckage of a white sea kayak was found at Edge Point, on the south tip of the island. The kayak and scattered remains of camping equipment matched what Hadwin had set off from Prince Rupert with 4 months prior. But there was one thing that was missing from the wreckage. A body. There were also some confusing details about the state of the wreckage. The fragments remaining from the kayak were quite large, which was unusual given how quickly the tides would typically smash stranded boats to shreds on the shores around here. As well, the sleeping bag, life jacket, and cook stove were found to be in nearly perfect condition. It appeared as though this wreck was closer to 1 month old rather than 4. Most strangely, though, was Hadwin's axe, which was found with the wreckage, but above the high tide line. The heaviest piece of gear from the wreck ended up above where the water would reasonably be able to launch it. More and more, it appeared as though the wreck had either already been tampered with or had been staged from the start. Given Hadwin's ability for surviving in perilous wilderness situations, it doesn't seem impossible that he could have faked his own death. One of the biggest concerns for his survival would have been hypothermia due to the rough winter conditions. But considering his tolerance for cold water swimming and more than 30 years of survival experience, he likely could have overcome this. He was fairly familiar with the coastal terrain from his previous shipwreck in Alaska, and knew a lot about what wild plants and animals he could eat to survive. And although his kayak was found on Mary Island, it's entirely possible that if he had disembarked somewhere remote on the mainland and pushed the boat out into the open ocean, that the tides would have carried it north all the way towards the island where it was found. Another matter that complicates the story is that the day that he left from Prince Rupert, credit card records show that he purchased $300 worth of food, which seems like an awful lot for just a 5-day trip. None of this food was found at the wreckage, but it could have easily been scavenged by animals within hours of the wreck. Each of these details don't seem to suggest anything on their own, but when pieced together, they present a possible scenario in which Hadwin didn't die, and is still out there somewhere. But since his disappearance, not a single person has heard from him. The beginning of 1997 marked the end for the Golden Spruce. That same year, McMillan Bloedel put together a team of forest researchers and experts to assess whether it would be feasible to move away from clear-cutting, partially in response to the Clackwit Sound protests 4 years prior. In June of 1998, MacBlow shocked the forest industry by announcing that they would be phasing out virtually all of their clear-cutting operations and moving towards clear-cutting with reserves. Clear-cutting with reserves is exactly what it sounds like. A standard clear-cut is carried out on a section of forest, but a small section of that plot is reserved and exempt from cutting. It may not seem like much, but the idea is to keep these reserves as small pockets of more natural forest that will help retain some of the forest's ecological diversity, in an attempt to balance the economic and environmental objectives for BC's forests. Most companies followed McMillan Bloedel's lead soon after the announcement of their change in forestry practices. Between 1970 and 1998, clear-cutting was used on 87% of forest area harvested on public lands in the province. By 2015, this number dropped to 11%, with clear-cutting with reserves dominating the industry at 85%. In 1999, McMillan Bloedel and all of its assets, including TFL 39 and Block 6, were sold to the American company Weyerhaeuser, the largest producers of wood products in the world. At the time of the sale, the Haida had a pending land claim in an overlapping area within the TFL, in which they claimed an Aboriginal right to harvest red cedar in that area. They were concerned that with this sale, by the time they had won their land claim, which often take years to settle, that the land would be stripped before they got access to the forests. In 2002, the Haida filed a lawsuit with the British Columbia Supreme Court to resolve the matter. When the provincial court ruled in favor of Weyerhaeuser, the ruling was appealed and kicked up to the Supreme Court of Canada. In 2004, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in favor of the Council of the Haida Nation in a decision that required that all First Nations be consulted by the government when actions were taken that affected their lands, even before pending land claims were settled. In 2005, Weyerhaeuser sold its coastal BC assets, including the logging rights to Block 6, in what was more or less a direct response to the Supreme Court of Canada ruling and ongoing litigation hurdles preventing them from logging. This prompted protests and blockades of logging roads in the islands, in an event that was later dubbed Island Spirit Rising, in yet another example of the tradition of West Coast civil disobedience against logging. The blockade ended after 4 weeks in a victory for the Haida, with an agreement to defer logging in the area for 3 years. An independent report published in 2020 estimated that only 3% of British Columbia's productive old-growth forests are left. Transforming the industry that the province was built on is a long and painful process, and there's concern about how much old growth will continue to be logged as changes in forest policy slowly make their way into law. But for the first time since industrial logging first started in the province, there's been a decline in the amount of timber harvested in British Columbia. Unfortunately, this isn't the good news that it sounds like. The province's allowable annual cut is projected to decrease over the next decade due to a reduced timber supply. This is due to a combination of factors, including historical overcutting, climate change, but mostly the mountain pine beetle epidemic which ravaged the province's interior forests in the late 90s and 2000s. Because of this, the allowable annual cut won't get back up to the all-time highs from the mid-2000s at any time over the next century, while the forests take time to recover. Now, with all of that said, the future of BC's forests is not all doom and gloom. In 2023, the provincial government announced a series of commitments towards legislating the protection of forests in BC. Some of these commitments include doubling the amount of protected areas in the province from 15 to 30% by 2030, and prioritizing conservation of the most diverse ecosystems in the province, including productive old-growth forests. The province has also doubled the BC Manufacturing Jobs Fund from $90 to $180 million, which, among other things, will help retrofit timber mills in the province to process smaller diameter second growth trees, rather than the old growth trees that many are still equipped for. Trees are the epitome of a renewable resource, and with proper forest management practices, it's completely possible to enjoy both the economic and environmental benefits of the Pacific temperate rainforests. Despite its death in 1997, the memory of the golden spruce lives on in the modern world. Several cuttings were taken from the tree throughout its life in an attempt to propagate its rare mutation, but most have struggled with surviving, and none are on pace to grow as tall as the golden spruce did. One was planted at Port Clements in 2001. Another one, one of the oldest cuttings, sits in the botanical garden at UBC in Vancouver, but has barely made it to head height in the 50-odd years that it's been growing. During its lifetime, the golden spruce inspired a number of artistic works, and continued to do so in death. An amazing series of 17 blankets were made by Haida artist Hazel Wilson in 2005 that chronicled the life and death of the tree, ending on a hopeful message for the future within the death of the spruce. The only wood ever harvested from the golden spruce was used in the Six String Nation project, which brought together artifacts from across Canadian history and geography to create a symbol of the diversity of culture and character that makes up Canada. Wood from the golden spruce makes up the entire top face of the guitar. To this day, Grant Hadwin's case is still considered open by the RCMP and Alaska State Troopers. In all likelihood, Hadwin is not missing, but perished on his trip up the coast. He was attempting a poor route, in a poor vessel, in poor weather, at a poor time of year. Although Grant Hadwin was better equipped to deal with extreme survival situations than most, the human body can only handle so much. That said, the nagging possibility that he did survive is hard to ignore. People like an unsolved mystery, and it's a lot more interesting to imagine the what-if of his survival than the probability of his death. But between dead or alive, there's a third possibility. The golden spruce was once a boy who was turned into a tree for disrespecting nature. Perhaps Grant Hadwin met the same fate, and all that's left of him is a tree near his shipwreck on Mary Island.